Hello? Hello? Is anybody out there? Is it just me? Has it just been me the whole time? What is time? Is it just a creation of the mind? A concept? A thought? Thoughts. Where did thoughts come from? Everything that has been created was first a thought. So who thunk the first thought? Thoughts become ideas that give inspiration or action, an electrical impulse from a source unknown, filled with infinite potential and possibility. What you do with it is your choice. All of our senses detect vibration. Our perceivable world is made of vibration. Sound, the universe. Universe. One song. Vibrating at different octaves and different densities. Together, we can choose to lift our world to a new plane of existence. One beyond fear, one beyond war, one beyond deceit. A world filled with love and compassion for one another. The thing is that it's going to take all of us working together. And when the veil is finally lifted, we'll realize we've been here the whole time. We just had to remember, and rejoin our place in the choir that is the universe.
Well, that was more than a microdose. Anyways, welcome everybody. Welcome to the Conscious Cloud. I am your host, Joe Izzo, and I've got to ask you guys a personal question. So, do you ever, try to nibble on a little bit of something and go about your day and the next thing you know, you realize you've been babbling psychedelic nonsense at your roommates for 30 minutes or an hour, and you've lost track of time. You don't know where you end and the rest of the world begins, and they look at you and they're confused and maybe concerned, and then you get self-conscious and you're like, am I being weird right now? And you're like, I'm definitely being weird right now. And then you start to question your own reality. Yep. Nope. Me either. Yeah, that never happens. And if it did happen to my roommates, I'm sorry. I love you guys. Thanks for listening. But no, I'm just playing. I want to record something fun and weird for the intro because I've got a very special guest on today's episode of the podcast, the great Zach Leary. And Zach Leary is the son of the great Timothy Leary. I feel so blessed to be able to have had this conversation with Zach, truly a wonderful individual. And, Zach was an integral part of allowing this podcast to come, the thought to come into my mind and then come into fruition. So thank you again to Zach. And yeah, so I'm super excited about this one, and we're just going to get right into it. So I'll see you guys on the other side, and I hope you enjoy the episode. Here we go. Welcome to the Conscious Cloud.
Thanks, Joe. It's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Thank you. Mr. Zach Leary here today. I am super excited to be doing this. You actually had, a hand in making this possible. So
I'm honored. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. So last May, actually, I went and had a psilocybin session with Zach, and it was the seed of this very podcast. So that was a really much needed experience in my life, and I know we had mentioned talking about this, and so that was kind of the seed that was planted and watered over the past year, and now it is finally starting to fruit and kind of come to fruition. So again, I'm super thankful and grateful that for the work that you do and put out there for others, because it has led to a very creative and fun thing in my life. So thank you.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, seeds get planted all the time, and it's really up to us to see them through, to take that germination process and do the work and follow it through. I know in my life, so many seeds have been planted that I haven't seen through, for whatever reasons, block us from fulfilling our own dharma. So it's great that you realized you're self-actualized, so to speak.
Yeah, no, and yeah, so again, just super appreciative, and you know, it's even weird how that whole experience came to be. You know, even I was traveling down to the Bay Area with my girlfriend at the time, and we were listening to the episode of you and Duncan on Duncan's podcast, and so that was, you know, kind of the spark, really. And I immediately, I think, emailed you after that and reached out and was like, hey, I want to do this thing. So it's really even cool how that even came to be too. So,
good
but
stuff.
Yeah, man. So how have you been? You know, I remember when I had come to do that, you had entered a seemingly, challenging, time in your life. So how have you been over the past like year and a half?
Yeah, it definitely was a challenging time in my life. And I, you know, I'm always cautious of using the words that I've gotten through it, like with an emphasis on it being permanent, but I am getting through it. You know, I think life is filled with all sorts of hurdles and adversity, and whether they are internally manifested or sparked by an external trigger, in which case mine was, you know, and yeah, you know, external forces can sometimes be puzzling or traumatic or confusing. And yeah, I had to do my work and confront my own demons, my own trauma, and my own, you know, the core of my being, to kind of look at who I am and find ways to get out of my own way to heal. But I'm doing much better. Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm happy to hear that. You know, I mean, I know it's difficult to experience anything, you know, especially when you're still needing to show up for the actual work you were doing. You know, like I'd come to have that session with you. So, I mean, I know that it can be tough when you're trying to like earn a living, and then also you have this very real, tangible other thing that's happening too. You know. So
yeah, it's really hard to do both. I mean, that's really became sort of the biggest obstacle in my life, is how do you, you know, take care of yourself and exercise some form of self-love and self-care while also being present, and able to show up for others. And that can be a very tricky line. And we see in so many forms of self-help, whether that is, you know, spiritual work or therapeutic work, that many facilitators get lost in their own mess, and, you know, transference can occur, and sort of like, you know, that mess can sort of overlap into, you know, the people they work with. And I really became cognizant of that, and had to pull away for a little bit to make sure that didn't happen. But yeah, it's a really good point. And for anybody who works with other people and helping them to grow spiritually or therapeutically, it's a dance.
Yeah, definitely. Especially because like we're, you know, we are the teachers and the students at the same time. So
always. Yeah, always.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's tough when the real stuff happens, and it's generally like when you least expect it as well, you know, just kind of going about your life, and then it's just, life is really full of surprises. Something then, I like to call them inconvenient learning experiences.
Right. Well, those are usually the best ones, right? It's like,
yeah,
like John Lennon said, life is what happens when you're busy making other plans. You know, it's the inconvenient ones are the ones that show up when you, that really test, I think, sort of put your feet to the fire and test, yourself to see, well, you know, all this work that I've done on myself, and is it like theoretical or is it practical? You know,
exactly.
Is it like, can I really, you know, put it to use now, when something happens? And that's always a powerful reminder for myself.
Yeah. Being able to walk the walk after you talk the talk. Right.
Right.
Yeah. Put all of that out there. I mean, that's why they call it spiritual practice. You have to practice it at some time. It's not just sitting, as good as it is to sit in silence and to center yourself, that's, you know, practice for being able to allow it to be practical when situations arise or the shit hits the fan and you're kind of like, all right, well, you know, how are you gonna, how do you, because we get to control our reactions to kind of the external stimuli of like when life events happen. And it's like, that's really like most of what you can do is just kind of control. And I mean, you can't really control the emotions maybe or the feelings that arise, but I guess your actions and reactions to them, right?
Exactly right. I mean, that's well said. I mean, you cannot control the, it's sort of like, you know, the paradigm of meditation. You know, I think meditation has, this narrative has sort of permeated throughout, you know, the gestalt about, around that meditation can like stop your thoughts, you know, and that you can get to the zone of a cessation of thinking. And that's just not true. I mean, you know, you never stop thinking. Even the thought around trying to stop thinking is a thought in and of itself. And meditation is the practice of recognizing your thoughts and being able to bear witness to them while separating your attachment from them, which in turn gets you to, you know, slow down the monkey mind and, you know, being able to recognize your emotions. Your emotions are always going to come up, whether they are happy, sad, angry, grateful, you know, all ends of the spectrum. It really doesn't matter. They are going to come up, and what you choose to do with them, that action that you put into place after they come up, you know, are we going to react? Or are we going to respond? Are we going to be impulsive, or are we going to have compassion? And I know in my life every day I am faced with situations like that. Usually interpersonal, you know, I'm a pretty, I think, sensitive guy, and I get set off pretty easily, and it's up to me on how I'm going to handle those situations. And, you know, awareness, I mean, through practice, I mean, like you were talking about practice before, you know, practice, whatever your spiritual practice is, it really trains the mind to, I think, give yourself tools to make better decisions. I mean, that's really all it is. It's just sort of giving yourself an arsenal that allows you to make better decisions. And hopefully they will be healthy.
Yeah, absolutely. Speaking of which, I actually, are you familiar with Mitch Horowitz?
A little bit, by name. I'm not too familiar with his work, but a little bit.
Yeah, he's somebody I found through Duncan as well. But he's had a couple books. Some of them come out, like one of them's Occult America. He's really into Manly P. Hall and you know, his teachings, which is more of like a esoteric philosophy type stuff. But anyways, he's doing a 30-day challenge right now, and it's pretty much like trying to keep your thoughts focused on positivity for 30 days. And so it's kind of under the guise of one of Neville Goddard's teachings, which is he believed that your imagination was God. And so kind of whatever you're focusing on in your life and whatever you're putting your thoughts into will kind of call more of that to you. So that's something I'm in the middle of right now. And it's actually been really nice to kind of reframe my own personal perspective to see when you kind of get into a conversation or like a seemingly negative thought pattern, not in a way to where, you know, it's like spiritually bypassing of what's actually happening, but more so kind of dropping into like the isness, you know, of what's kind of unfolding in front of you. So
are you doing the 30-day challenge?
Yes. Currently doing the 30-day challenge. I think it's like day 10 or 11 right now.
Wow. Well, congratulations. Yeah. Let me know how it goes. That's I think intellectually that sounds like, oh, I could do that. But I think in practicality, that's difficult, especially during these times. I mean, we are living in a very volatile world. And I think that is perhaps the one thing that everyone can agree upon, no matter what side of the fence you fall on. We are living in a very volatile world right now, and it is difficult to stay positive.
Well, cool. That leads me to some of the questions I had then. So, so how do you feel about the direction that humanity has taken currently?
Oh man, that's a large question, Joe.
or you know, I mean, I'm hopeful, but I'm like idealistically hopeful. I don't know. I mean, you don't get me wrong. Even during this 30-day challenge, my thoughts still lead to places where I'm like, why am I thinking this? You know, I told my roommates I have to fire the people at the Thought Factory because I'm not really excited about what they're making most of the time. You know, it's like, where do these thoughts even come from? And who's the person manufacturing them? Right? I guess it's like our past experiences or something.
Right.
And so, I don't know. I'm personally hopeful. I feel like with the way the election went, just because we're in Oregon and measure 109 and 110 pass,
yeah,
which is
that's great. Yeah.
Yeah. I worked on the campaign. So
cool.
That was something that was super dear to me. And then, you know, the general election is whatever. But I don't know. It felt like somebody kind of turned the lights on. So I just was curious about, you know, maybe how you felt about that.
I mean, look, man, I'm an optimist too. I really am. Mm-hmm. I can just sort of like narrow this answer or this discussion just to the microcosm of America. I'm an optimist. I believe in the power of humanity's ability to innovate, to kind of, you know, have a course correction, so to speak. So I do remain an optimist, but, you know, these days, you know, I guess being the technologist that I am and the, you know, I'm kind of a media junkie as well. You know, we're living in this world that has multiple narratives going on I don't want to use the word truth, but of, you know, I guess just of facts, you know, and I'm not like saying, you know, CNN or the New York Times or any mainstream media establishment is a purveyor of facts nonstop. I mean, of course they have biases, you know, I'm not defending them, but you know, the reporting of the news is sort of the reporting of the news, and then the reporting of the news and shifting it to create false narratives to perpetuate outcomes that you want based on facts that don't exist, it's just a really troubling practice that America has fallen into, because it is, you know, you're dealing with sort of like a cognitive dissonance that can't be reasoned with, that can't be argued with, trying to, you know, mold realities to fit a narrative that doesn't exist. And that is a really tricky thing that we are going to have to figure out how to overcome. I mean, on a very simple level, I mean, you could just take the election and Trump's refusal to concede and you know, those things, and you just kind of see that community's leanings towards what it is they're trying to get out of it. And it's sort of like you are talking to a stubborn child or something that refuses to admit that they spilt the milk. You know, it's the same psychology. It's like, well, no, of course you spilt the milk. Like you're the only one here, and it's okay that you spilt the milk. You know, and you're dealing with these things, and it's just, it's really, really, really troubling. And in this brave new world of sort of dystopian media environments, it's anybody's guess how that's going to work itself out. But again, I do remain an optimist. And I mean, with the election itself, I mean, yeah, what happened in Oregon was fantastic with those two propositions. And what I'm most encouraged about around the election was that voter turnout was so high.
Yeah, amazing.
Yeah, that is really amazing. That does give me pause because, you know, it was the anti-Trump election. It wasn't about Biden. I mean, Biden is kind of a neutral candidate. You know, he's not great. He's not terrible. He's just kind of there, you know. And so if another person does come around who is actually kind of fantastic, you know, say, I mean, you know, Bernie wasn't able to, you know, to pull through for whatever reasons. And that's a whole other conversation. But, you know, there are some good people out there who are still advocating for change. And I do think that there's hope for them.
Yeah, I do too. And it's interesting, though, how ideals have shifted for a lot of people and how a lot of people have been convinced to vote against their own interests.
Oh, my God. Oh my God. That is the
so
great
puzzling.
It's the great coup of the Republican Party is how they have gotten their base to vote for them when they are the body that is harming them the most. It's an unbelievable marketing strategy that worked. You know, I mean, these are, you know, pro big business, pro international globalization. These are the people who are anti-middle class, who are, you know, pro 1%, but somehow they've gotten, you know, the poorest, most disenfranchised people in white rural America to vote for them. Amazing.
It really is. I mean, I give a lot of that credit to Roger Stone for doing what he's done since he's been with Nixon. So if you guys don't know who Roger Stone is, check out Roger Stone or the documentary Get Me Roger Stone. It's really, I don't know. It's difficult, especially because I've got friends that are all across the board with a lot of this stuff. And you know, I try to be as compassionate to people as I possibly can and try to, you know, listen to folks. And but, you know, I think that's, you know, I love Ram Dass. I remember he, you know, when talking about this sort of thing, when we were at the retreat in 2016, he was just like, love everybody. You know, you don't have to go to dinner with them. But, you know, and that's a tough incarnation and there's a lot of karma there, but, you know, loving them. So it's like, how do you love people that are so upset? You know?
Well, I mean, Ram Dass said it, you know, so well, love everybody's soul, but you don't have to love their incarnations. Mm-hmm. And, you know, depending what view of spirituality you have, but, you know, obviously, I lean towards the Eastern paradigms. You know, there are people who are born into karmic cycles that they're not going to be able to break this lifetime, you know, and they're stuck in a world of ignorance and a world of hate and a world of fear. And it's, you know, most likely not going to work itself out this lifetime. And their incarnations are, you know, it's tragic, it's sad, or really hard to reckon with. But I have tremendous compassion for them, you know, I do. And when I see these angry Trump voters, you know, I have tremendous compassion for their suffering, because at the end of the day, you know, they sort of kind of want the same thing that everybody wants. They want a better life for their family. You know, they want job security. They want economic opportunity. You know, it's sort of like their base kind of ideals are sort of in line. I mean, sort of. Then there's, of course, the whole race card on top, which is a whole other thing. But and it's I have tremendous compassion for them and just loving their souls and knowing that they are suffering just like the rest of us.
Yeah, and we're all doing the best that we can, or at least we hope we're all out here doing the best that we can. Well, cool. Yeah. So let's see. I want to shift gears here. And so what was it like growing up with Timothy Leary as your father?
it's a complicated question to answer. And it's one I've been asked, you know, so many countless times. And the answer to it shifts. Well, I shouldn't say shifts, but it's evolved. As I get older, you know, when I was younger, I really had no objectivity to it, because that was just the person I grew up with. You know, I didn't know any different. That was just my father, and it was what it was. It was like any other household, you know. It's just, he was my father, and I didn't know really that it was all that different until later, until I sort of got older and had long-term friendships that evolved over the years, and romantic partners whose lives I was able to witness, and you know, through just the task of being human, I was able to sort of realize that I did have a pretty different childhood, and my dad Timothy was he was an incredible force, an incredible mind, an incredible human being, a very good father in a traditional sense, and the way that, you know, gave me lots of attention, took me to baseball games, made sure I did my homework, you know, those standard things, gave me a lot of love, and was always there for me. but he also operated in a realm that few of us will ever be able to operate in. He was brilliant. You know, he really had a once in a generation mind. And that is the part that, as I get older, is difficult to kind of make peace with, because you do fall into the cliche. It's like, when I see people like John Lennon's kids, like Sean or Julian, like, who are both musicians, and good musicians. Absolutely. Sean is a really sweet guy and a really good musician, but he'll never be able to escape from the comparison or the shadow of, and it's, he's trapped forever, And, I find that difficult. It's like any work that I do within the psychedelic community, I'm sort of damned for life, but, the work and the karmas kind of go to me in developing my own identity and my own voice. And if there's one thing my dad was really good at, was authenticity, and encouraging authenticity. Yeah.
Well, I think you're doing a great job, Zach, and I'm super appreciative of the work that you're doing, because without the work in you putting yourself out there, this conversation might not have been possible. So,
thank you.
Absolutely, man. And I you're a really sweet person, and like, after having our experience, I figured that things were maybe a little bit difficult, and so I always hold you in a high regard, and send good vibes your way.
Thanks, man.
Yeah, absolutely. Did you ever do psychedelics with your pops?
I did. Yeah, I did. I did. When I first started doing psychedelics, I started probably a little bit younger than I should have, thanks to the Grateful Dead. I was a deadhead and followed them religiously around the country. And in no way was my dad an advocate for indiscriminate use. He was not a fan of, kids who were probably a little too young doing psychedelics. I remember when I was 14, 15, somewhere around there, he told me that, look, you're going to do what you want to do, but trust me when I say, your mind is not fully developed yet, and you will get the most benefit out of this when you're older. I need to tell you that. But once the wheels fell off, there was nothing he could really do about it. And we did have some, we had a couple journeys specifically that were really, really, really special.
That's so cool. I think that's something as psychedelics get destigmatized, as we move forward, that there's going to be a lot of really amazing generational healing when you can have grandparents, parents, and children be able to take psychedelics with each other and really break down those like familial barriers, of what it's like to fulfill the role of being the mom or the grandmother or the son or whatever title you've been given in your family. And I'm really hopeful and excited to see, how that all kind of plays out for everybody.
Yeah, man, that is a really, really great point. The generational gaps are really closed. They're really getting much, much smaller than they have ever been before. It's all these deadheads are having children, all these burners are having children, and in the 60s, that was the big sort of like friction within the 60s. The generation gap was so wide. All these hippie kids, like their parents were like 1940s and 50s, post-World War II, establishment, white picket fence, clean cut.
They've been sold.
Yeah, just really,
they've been sold,
really, really narrow in their view of consciousness. And we're seeing, people like us having children all the time. And I think that's a huge reason why, like what happened in Oregon and the election happened, is because, that generation gap has shrunk. And the people who were once the elders, they're now us.
Yeah, it's weird to think about. It's definitely strange to think about, and like how we've kind of come in at this pivotal time. I've talked to this with other friends of mine, and they're like, don't you think everyone who incarnates comes at like the most pivotal time in humanity? I'm like, I guess, but this is undeniably different.
Yeah, you know, it is.
Like, 2020 is undeniably different than the rest of it. I mean, as a lot of really amazing spiritual teachers start to emerge, and with the rise of technology, you know, it's gotten really interesting how fast we can share data with each other. I mean, it is like, I don't know, you wouldn't this whole podcast itself wouldn't have been possible, like, even, I don't, maybe 20 years ago. Like, the internet's so new to us.
Yeah, it is.
And being able to share ideas and concepts within seconds, you can post something online, and, you know, if you're The Rock, you've reached like millions of people. I think he has like the most followers on Instagram now. It's like you reach millions of people in just a matter of seconds, you know.
It's an amazing thing. Yeah, I mean, the, you know, the promise of like the early cyber pioneers of you know, the Stuart Brands and Steve Jobs and John Perry Barlow's of the world, who really saw the egalitarian opportunity of technology's ability to disseminate, you know, ideas so quickly and so evenly across the board. It is a beautiful, beautiful thing to watch. But we're also seeing the, you know, the cautionary aspect of it as well. Like we were talking about earlier, in that, you know, false narratives can spread so quickly, you know?
And that, especially with the deep fake technology and stuff too.
Oh my God. Yeah.
That's creepy. I often wonder, you know, you see these technologies that they create in, like, let's say Bourne Identity and these eyeball scanners and stuff. And now we have thumbprint scanners. And so it's interesting to see the technology catch up to what's in the movies, which I guess, you know, that's how like even cell phones came to be with like Star Trek, right? Like people designing these devices in a sci-fi show, and now it's real,
right?
You know, we have these like handheld supercomputers.
Oh my God. Yeah. I mean, the new chips inside the iPhone 12 are, you know, they're faster than this laptop that I'm talking to you on, you know.
Wild.
Yeah, it's wild to see. And the that the exponential growth, you know, Moore's law around, you know, chip processing power and you know, the applications that we are going to use them for. I mean, it's incredibly, incredibly promising. I mean, I have a lot of admiration and faith in technology's sort of ability to connect us and to give us solutions that are practical and available, you know. So I do remain hopeful for that. I'm not one of those spiritualist new age guys who's like advocates a disconnection from technology, and that, of course, you know, getting back to nature and having, you know, time away from our digital devices and, you know, operating just with our feet in the ground and the dirt, it's a necessary, very important thing for us all to do. But we do need to embrace these tools that we're given and use them wisely and make intelligent choices around how we use them and the model that we are setting up for our children. It's really important.
Definitely. I think it's bringing, like, being conscious and bringing awareness to your device time, or how much time you're spending doing things, or what you're doing, you know, while you're on your device. And so I, you know, after seeing like the documentary, like The Social Dilemma, and a lot of my friends immediately deleted some of their social media profiles. Mm. I just, being aware of maybe that's how the technology works. And I ultimately think it's like we've entered a world where people are just selling stuff. You know, I mean, that's kind of how it's always been. Like when the radio was invented, you know, it was like finding shows that you could sell advertisement space in between the shows. When television came out, it was like, it was about the shows, but it was more so about the commercials that you know, getting viewers to pay attention so you can have commercial space. And so I think that's kind of what's developed with our iPhones. This is a lot of just, they're just trying to, like, Amazon's trying to sell you junk all the time. So really just kind of like being aware of that. But also at the same time, like, it's such a great tool to be able to connect with like-minded folks and build a community and find other folks that.
Yes, it is. It is, absolutely is. I think we just have to be conscious of the bubble, of staying within, you know, the filter bubble. The filter bubble is a real thing, you know, and how we can, yes, connecting with other like-minded folks is a great thing, and building our communities and, you know, discussing ideas and sharing ideas. But the way that the algorithm is designed, it's designed to keep us in our own bubble. You know, it's designed mm-hmm. to, you know, filter out things that the algorithm thinks we are not interested in, or points of view that we're not interested in. And I do try to make an effort to kind of disrupt the algorithm a little bit. And like the social dilemma, you know, yeah, it's very, very powerful information in that. And Roger McNamee, who's in that show, he was on my podcast, and I know him a little bit. And, you know, and it's disrupting the algorithm in a way that does not, you know, cater to our, to what it thinks we want. And so we can get other points of view is really important, because both the left and the right are kind of staying within their little ecosystem. You know, we have to see what the other side is doing and listen to them, you know, so we can have intelligent discourse and not just exclude or kind of create an us and them mentality.
Yeah. And I think it continues to divide and polarize people. And there's a lot of like self-righteousness, I feel, to a degree, like kind of selfish righteousness and piousness, especially with folks on the left side of things, where it's like, you know, I don't know, it just kind of comes off as like having your like nose up in the air at people, you know? And so I think, yeah, being able to communicate with each other, and is the same thing as like a bunch of my friends were Bernie supporters. And then when he didn't win the nomination, people were having like full on meltdowns. And it's like, how many friends do you have on social media? Like, right, let's say 1,000 people, and you have most of them agree with you. So it's like, it's the same thing with the election too. When their candidate doesn't win, and like, they're like, but my 250 friends all agree with me. I've deleted and silenced and blocked and unfollowed every single other person that didn't agree with me. And now when this thing doesn't happen the way that we thought it should, people just go into full meltdown mode, because we've like almost monocropped our friend group, right?
Yeah.
We've gotten rid of diversity. We've cut everything down. We built these, you know, we're growing corn everywhere. We've literally like industrially farmed even our friend group.
Yeah, and that's not healthy for anyone. It really isn't.
No.
Yeah, and it creates it creates more discourse, and especially in the political spectrum, because, you know, politics is not it's not a zero sum game. You know, it's like it like progress happens with little like, you know, fits and starts, with little like small wins. You know, rarely does, you know, a mega huge revolution or a huge piece of policy like happen overnight. These days, you know, it's mm-hmm. you know, they're little. You've got to just chip away at it a little bit, little by little by little. And sure, Biden is not the dream of Bernie Sanders. He's absolutely not. But it is a step in the right direction, considering what we're coming from. And yeah, we just all can't like, you know, take our toys and go home and whine about it. It's, you know, nothing's going to work out that way if we keep doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, I try to encourage conversation and unity and harmony in whatever way possible, because the difference between harmony and dissonance is just a half step, you know, if you're playing an instrument, right?
All right. And so, good point. That's a good metaphor. Yeah.
Yeah. We're just a half step away from harmony. So hopefully we can encourage each other to take that half step up or that half step down, so we can understand each other and be able to listen with our hearts and not just our ears, you know. So you're just waiting to constantly respond, you know. It's really important to be able to like take information in and kind of process it, or be able to see where people are coming from. And I feel a lot of people are doing that. I mean, it's interesting that with coronavirus kind of happening, that a lot of folks won't be able to get together for the holidays. So maybe that'll save some tough conversations and infighting with the family. We can argue over Zoom maybe. Yeah. So,
yeah, coronavirus has been a really good litmus test, I think, for I think for kind of the interpretation of information and how it disseminates and how we kind of take it in and understand it. And, you know, people's kind of biases towards conspiracy theories and public health. And I don't know, it's just been a really, it's been a really interesting one to watch, because I don't think coronavirus is linear at all. I think it's, I think it's a very real thing that, nobody has the solution to.
No, and we're seeing, that's the thing with 24-hour news stations. We see this stuff unfold in front of our eyes, and so how can anybody know what to do properly? Because we're all learning together, you know, how these things are working and unfolding, and it's tough, you know, because it's like you want to be patient, but then people want a vaccine, but then are people going to take the vaccine? So it's such a multifaceted thing that I personally don't even know where to begin with any of it, other than to just be as cautious as possible, because like, you're not making things worse if you're being cautious, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. That's a really, really well said. And on, you know, the simplest issue of like mask wearing, like I never understood the cognitive dissonance and sort of like resistance around the mask thing, coming from like, you know, far left, from the far left side of things, like the, I mean, there are some, you know, really smart kind of like Joe Rogan, for instance, not that he's far left, but like, I mean, it's such a simple thing to do, you know, and, you know, whether or not it's effective. And if it's only, hey, I don't know what the number is, but if it's only like 5% more effective, hey, well, that's 5%. And if it, you know, if it saves one life, you know, do it. I just don't really understand what the resistance was around something so simple. You know, like you were saying, being cautious, you know, being overly cautious is never, in this situation, it's, you know, how is that harmful, you know?
Well, yeah, especially if it makes other people feel better and you're being respectful towards other human beings. I mean, I don't know the math. I don't know the science behind a lot of this stuff. You know, it's like I have to get my information from pretty much the same place as everyone else gets it. But it's like, if it's just a small gesture, and for me, it's like, okay, it's a, you know, I flew in April and got on a plane and had a bandana around my neck, didn't really use it at that point in time, and just flew recently. And it's like hardcore now. So, I mean, I don't know. It's like, if it makes other people feel better and it's like, you know, it's a small thing that you can do that may help people, then I just don't get why people are so upset about it, and why it's gotten so politicized. It's so interesting how ideas are so quick to become politicized.
Yeah.
And from what I understand about it, it's folks, especially on the conspiracy side of things, it's like, well, if they can get us to wear masks, what else can they get us to do?
Right.
I don't know, man. Like I don't know. Give them your ID every time you get on a plane and submit to a security search. Like, you give them your iPhone thumbprint on the new iPhone you bought. You're complaining about these things on social media. I know your name, all of your friends, pretty much where you live. I could probably find out what you bought on Amazon. So the mask is where you draw the line.
Right.
Not any of the Apple account. I know all the music you listen to, who you follow on Spotify. I can find out all of this information easily. Because you give it away, and the mask is where you're like, I can't do it. I've drawn the line at the mask.
That's really funny, man. It's a really good point. Yeah.
It conceals your identity. You should, in fact, like the mask. Cowboys wear masks. You guys think you're patriots and cowboys. Just wear the mask. We won't know who you are because you've already given me all of your other information.
Yeah. And in that world, the best, I'm always confronting that argument with like, with Google. It's like, you know, everybody loves to complain about these things, but they're using Google a zillion times a day. It's like, do you realize what it is Google tracks and how it tracks you and what kind of profile it's built around you? It's like, it's the most onerous of them all, you know, and like the whole PRISM thing around the Patriot Act and the cooperation with the NSA. I mean, that is not a tinfoil hat conspiracy. That was real, you know, and
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, hey, if you put your money where your mouth is and stop using Google, stop using Amazon, you know, use a Tor browser, use DuckDuckGo. You know, nobody does that, you know, and it's just like,
it's inconvenient.
Yeah, let's just randomly pick an issue to be militant about. And it's like, yeah, but all of that aside, you know, and I'm a, you know, I've led a complicated life in the sense, you know, I used to be an active drug addict and had terrible substance abuse problem and did a lot of shady things back in my addiction 20 years ago to stay high. And there are things that I'm not proud of, but it really gave me the perspective of that, well, shit, if I'm not doing anything wrong, I have nothing to worry about. I don't give a fuck if Google is tracking my every click. I'm not looking at anything strange or anything criminal or anything dangerous. I really, really don't care, you know? And it's like, and same with Amazon, you know, I talk to Alexa all the time, you know, and it's like, I have nothing to worry about, you know, if my actions, you know, are in alignment, I really don't care how the tech genome mapping profile thing is working. You know, I have nothing to hide.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah.
What have you, so what has kept you kind of motivated through COVID, you know, and like having time alone, you know, I mean, you know, you mentioned, you said that you have been clean, I guess, for a while now. What's kind of kept you, motivated and hopeful?
Oh, well, I mean, COVID was it's been this really strange opportunity that has forced everyone to go inward, you know, and we talk about this in, you know, spiritual circles all the time, you know, go within, you know, look within. And that's all fine and well when we're living our lives and going to work and all this, but COVID has really forced you to look within, you know, especially in the early months when the quarantines were, you know, they were pretty severe. And, you know, I really looked at it as an opportunity to what contentness means, you know, what are the things that really make me content, that make me less anxious. So I'm not, you know, pacing around my house and thinking, you know, there's someplace I have to be, or I'm not doing this, or I need this, or I don't need that, or, you know, the whole kind of syndrome of needing more or having to go out and spend, and just to sort of what it looks like to have a simple, content filled life. And that's what this has done for me. And I feel pretty good about that. I've used the time wisely. I've brushed up on my French. I've been playing a lot more guitar, you know, awesome. Kind of things like that. Yeah. It's, all in all, it's been great. The only thing that I'm really starting to kind of be a little pissed off at is the absence of live music and not being able to go to shows. That's the thing. I'm just like, shit, man. And I don't know how you feel about it, but I read some article that was on Billboard the other day that, like, you know, Ticketmaster is figuring out how they're going to proceed. And one of the possible options is have proof of a vaccine. To buy a ticket, or proof of a negative test within the previous 48 hours. One of the two.
I'll do that.
Yeah. I don't know. Where do you sit on the vaccine thing?
I'm not an anti-vaxxer, but I think it's that people should, I don't know enough information about it. I'm not educated enough about it personally. I think these new vaccines that are coming out for COVID, I think the more recent one they did is 95% accurate. I don't trust pharmaceutical companies, really. I just, having seen what after the opioid crisis and the fact that I've got friends and family members that are still on benzos and opiates, and I've seen its effect on people, I don't particularly like or trust the pharmaceutical industry. I don't know how much they were given a bunch of money to make these vaccines. And so I think that's kind of even a bipartisan thing where I think everybody's kind of
is kind of cautious about the vaccine. You know, I don't know. I think if it was, I don't know. I think it needs more time personally. I don't know if the politicians aren't doing it, if they feel iffy about it, I don't think I'm going to do it, you know, at least until they can, you know, be flushed out more.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I feel I'm very conflicted about
it. Yeah, me too. You know? Me too. I'm really conflicted about it. I keep defaulting to my base emotions. Like, fuck, I want to go to shows. You know, I want to see Dead and Company next summer. If I have to,
absolutely.
I have to take a vaccine, I'm going to do it. But then I'm like, oh, wait a second. It's a little too simple. I don't know.
Yeah. If Bobby does it, I'll do it. How about that? Whatever Bobby does, I'll do.
Okay. I'm going to go with that.
Yeah, well, no, seriously, whatever Bobby does, if Bobby does it, I'll do it, because if he lives through it, or Phil lives through it, then chances are I'll be okay.
Right, yeah. These are not young men.
No, right. if they, you know, Bobby's out there swinging his hammer. If he can do it, if Bob Weir can do it, I'll do it. How about that?
Okay, let's reconvene on this. I'll go with that. Let's check in a few months.
Yeah, because if that means I get to go tour the West Coast and go see Dead and Company, then yeah, I'll probably do it, you know. Man, well, speaking about weird, so do you have any fun stories of hanging out with some of these cool people, or you know, I know that you knew Ram Dass, I guess, maybe a little bit more than most folks.
Yeah.
Do you have any fond memories or stories?
Well, of Ram Dass specifically?
Any of these really awesome people, you know, maybe Ram Dass.
Yeah, there's so many. I mean, yeah, I knew Ram Dass very, very well. Where to start? I mean, yeah, there are so many. I mean, Ram Dass, I knew Ram Dass throughout my whole life and really didn't get personally very close with him until I was older, because when I was younger, I was always really freaked out by him. I was like, who is this guy who shines so brightly? You know, that look in his eyes. And anytime he'd come around, it would just intimidate the fuck out of me. I was just like, God, I can't be around. I was just like, why is this guy beaming like this all the time? And so when I was younger, it was sort of like, it was a lot for me to take in. But as I got older, I mean, yeah, I developed a really beautiful friendship with him. But the Dead guys, you know, I was, I wouldn't consider myself a friend with Bob Weir. I mean, I know him. He probably knows my name when I see him, you know, and hung out with him, you know, a handful of times over the years. But, you know, the Timothy Leary sort of imprint on Grateful Dead culture was a little rocky. You know, they were more of the Ken Kesey school, you know. I mean, they liked Tim, you know, Jerry liked Tim a lot. But Bobby was a little trepidation around him, but hey, Bobby's always been really good to me. I mean, I've always been blessed with access to Grateful Dead tickets. And I have to think that's because, yeah, sure, they had a lot of respect for Timothy and his work. But the one thing I'll say about Bobby, and for all you music fans out there, Bobby, every time I see him, I mean, he knows what a super fan I am. I mean, I'm admittedly like obsessively encyclopedic about the Grateful Dead, and I'm a musician. And Bobby always asks me about the music, about how it sounded, about, you know, what I thought of the show. And he's asked me if, you know, what could have been different, and could you hear everyone? How's John Mayer doing? And I really, you know, I really thought that was so cool of him, you know, after all these years, you know, doing this, that he still cares about the music and asking for, you know, a fan's opinion.
That's awesome.
For what that's worth, I always take great, I have so much fun with that, because I nerd out so hard. I'm like, oh, that's so cool that he cares, you know?
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, it's probably an even more difficult question, but what's your favorite Grateful Dead song?
Oh, song, impossible to say. I don't really look at a song. I have like my favorite. I have my favorite eras.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, okay, but what's the is there something that comes every time you hear it, it makes you just a little happier? If you go to see them live, you just really hope that maybe they play that song?
Probably Terrapin.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah, I mean, Terrapin always brings, you know, great joy to my heart and makes me tear up a little bit, really makes me miss Jerry Garcia a lot. It's just such a great one to see.
Yeah, the first time I saw Dead & Company, they played that, fortunately, which was really cool. Yeah, I like Estimated Profit a lot.
Estimated's a great one. Mm-hmm. One thing I really love about Dead & Company, and I wish they do some of it, but I love them exploring like the Bob Weir deep cuts, you know, the Let It Grow and Lost Sailor, Saint of Circumstance, and Black Throated Wind, and, you know, kind of Stranger, and, you know, just the classic Bob Weir tunes. I love seeing them dust those off.
Yeah, last time when they were in Eugene, they played Black Throated Wind. It was funny. My buddy was like, "This is the one song I want to hear. One song I want to hear." They started playing it, and he just started freaking out.
Oh, very
out.
Cool.
I hadn't heard that one before, so I felt like I was like, "Man, I'm missing out." I was a little late to the Grateful Dead thing. So.
Well, John Perry Barlow was who wrote the lyrics to that song and to most of Weir's tunes. I was really close with him, and he was our closest link to the Grateful Dead, and. Barlow died about 3 years ago now, and learned a lot from Barlow, so I always appreciate seeing his songs being played.
That's awesome, man. Well, okay, I got another one for you. If you could tell young Zach Leary anything, what would it be?
To cultivate the practice of discipline a little bit more, and to, as weird as it is to say, but to take the warnings of hard drugs more seriously. Yeah.
Definitely. Well, cool. So What are you currently working on? How can anybody who's listening to this find a way to support you?
Oh, well, it's nice of you to ask. I mean, right now, I'm going to fire my podcast back up before the end of the year, and look for that. But currently I'm working on a new book called And Now the Work Begins, A Manual for Psychedelic Integration. Awesome. And the book is specifically a manual for intent and post-journey integration. It's not a book on how to trip better during the journey. It's what to do with what you've discovered during the journey and apply it to your life afterwards.
Awesome.
And I just think, integration has sort of been a hot topic in the community, but I think that manual is lacking. So I sort of got called to write it, and yeah, that's what I'm working on.
That's awesome. What a great time to put something out like that, with the stuff that's happening in Oregon, and really hopefully that's going to happen all over the world as psychedelic medicines become more popular, as people start doing the deep inner work. I think that's a much needed manual, and we need more books out there to help inform people so they can really not just have this experience and be able to like go to tell their friends, and they have a way to integrate it themselves, you know, so it can go beyond the experience itself and really find a way to cultivate more practice from it.
Yeah, man. Oh yeah, thank you for the reassurance. We just have to remember, you know, the experience itself is temporary, it's short. You know, it's mm-hmm. not the, I mean, it's the spark that lights the fire, but it is not the fire itself. It's what you do with it afterwards and how you apply it to your daily life that really matters. So you don't get caught in the trap of thinking that you need to trip over and over and over and over and over again. You know, I mean, sure, yeah. Doing it many times is helpful, but it doesn't need to be like something that you have to do over and over again to get the insight. You know, it's like you can get the insight and then apply it to your daily practice, and so it can change your life, you know, and that's where the work is.
Yeah, and having these macro doses, you know, when needed, or to shift maybe somebody who's been stuck in a pattern that's not particularly benefiting them anymore. And so those macro doses are really useful during those times. And then, you know, microdosing is also something super beneficial to do in the intermediary, you know.
Definitely.
Yeah. In between maintenance, you know. So, well, cool. Yeah. So one question that I ask everyone that comes on the podcast, being that this is the Conscious Cloud, you know, and it's kind of it's a metaphor for the collective consciousness. And so one question I always ask everybody is, what would you like to upload to the Conscious Cloud for other folks to download?
What would I like to upload to the Conscious Cloud? I think that everyone has to do their part to listen to each other better, to, as the sort of the gap is widening between, you know, the us and them mentality of our communities, that we have to, on all sides of the fence, as difficult it is to do, we have to stop and listen better and engage in discourse and polite, calm, informative discussion, and not become so inflammatory and so judgmental and so polarizing. And that begins with us, that begins with the individual. You know, that's not up to media to do on its own. It's not up to, you know, our leaders to do on their own. It's up to us. And that's what I'd like to upload. Yeah.
Awesome. Beautiful, Zach. Thank you for that.
Yeah, man.
Well, cool. I think, yeah, it puts us in about an hour.
Cool. So, well, thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure. Yeah, man.
Absolutely. Thanks for being here, Zach. I appreciate you a bunch. Thanks for taking time out of your day to come and be a part of this. And I'm excited for your book. I'll definitely include some information in when I upload this, and for how folks can get in contact with you and all that. So again, thanks for being here. I appreciate it.
All right, bro. Thanks, man.
Again, Mr. Zach Leary. Thank you, thank you, thank you. If you want to check out Zach's personal podcast, it's called the It's All Happening podcast. He's also on the MAPS podcast, which is the Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies. If psychedelics are something that interests you, I highly recommend checking out MAPS. You can further your interest and knowledge there. They are doing clinical trials for MDMA right now, among other things. If you want to connect with Zach on Instagram, it's at Zach Leary. Drome, D-R-O-M-E. If you enjoyed today's episode of The Conscious Cloud, please subscribe to the podcast. Give us a good rating on iTunes if you have it. And until next time, folks, be the frequency you want to see. Be the frequency you want to see. I love you guys.